Scholar Aaron David Miller. Aaron David Miller watched last night's debate through a different lens than most of us. He's a foreign policy expert, a former advisor to six secretaries of state during both Republican and Democratic administrations. He has also written five books, including one entitled The End of Greatness: Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. So what did he think during the debate? Well, at one point he tweeted, "I think Andy Yang is terrific." He also made note of the lack of discussion of foreign policy in the debate. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Miller lives in Maine part-time and is with us in the studio for a wide-ranging discussion about everything from presidential politics to foreign affairs. Have you been thinking about Iran, Israel, America's place in the world? What is your question for Aaron David Miller? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. My guest today analyzes and connects unfolding events around the world and here at home, from the developments in the Strait of Hormuz to negotiations with Kim Jong-un to the race for the U.S. presidency. Aaron David Miller is a distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center, International Center for Scholars, and an expert on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as well as U.S. policy in the Middle East. He served as an advisor to six secretaries of state from both parties and is currently a global affairs analyst for CNN. He has written five books, joins me in our studio today. Aaron, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Jennifer, pleasure to be here, truly.
As always, we want to hear from you. Which issues concern you most? Tensions with Iran, potential North Korean nuclear weapons, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? Or do you want to talk about last night's Democratic presidential debate? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll start with the debates. And you were tweeting during the debates. You tweeted, "I think Andy Yang is terrific." You tweeted, "Foreign policy, anyone? Anyone? National security, Russian hacking, anyone?" So now, the morning after, do you have anything to add to that?
You know, the debates are really rather remarkable. I also tweeted out that it's not Lincoln Douglas. And I think in part that's part of the problem. It's very difficult to do station identification with 10 others on the stage. There'll be several debates. The numbers will winnow. In fact, I also tweeted out that the primary objective of this debate was to get from 10 to 5, because I don't really believe that the American public, fascinated by what's unfolding here, is going to be able to understand either the character of these men and women or the details, the granularity of some of the issues without a more intense exchange back and forth. So that winnowing process began and continued over the last two nights with CNN debates. But it's a long campaign, and I think you could probably take a nap and we could wake up in January of 2020 and continue watching the movie, because there's going to be a lot of highways and byways before then.
I think a lot of people share your frustration that there was not much discussion at all about international affairs. I know I'm one of those people, but I kind of also understand why the debate moderators are not asking these questions, because the conventional wisdom is that voters don't care about foreign policy. They vote with their wallet. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I don't. I think that Americans want the United States to be a force for positive change in the world. I think they look toward their presidents to be strong, empathetic, prudent, and wise. And I think they also want to see presidents who know what they don't know and who are in a hurry to find out. And I think, by and large, obviously, those candidates will not answer questions that they're not asked. I work for CNN, and I'm not being critical of this, but I would point out one stunning fact, and that is, with the exception of Tulsi Gabbard, no other candidate, either in their opening statements or their closing statements, dealt with the two longest wars in American history, Afghanistan and Iraq in any meaningful way. I find that to be stunning on one hand and extraordinarily depressing on the other. Maybe it's because we have a volunteer military. Maybe it's because people are simply exhausted and fatigued with unwinnable wars. Or maybe it's the fact, essentially, that the military is at war, but not the country. And that is a serious problem when you put American men and women in harm's way.
Oh, sure. So few American families are actually dealing with a family member who's deployed to one of these wars.
I mean, I really do believe if you had a draft in this country, and I'm not recommending one, although I'm very high in the issue of some form of national service, you would not see the United States deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan for 18 and 19 years, respectively.
Your most recent book was The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. But it came out 5 years ago. Now, with everything going on in the world, do you stand by the thesis of the book?
I do. And it's an annoying thesis. I think that Americans are not prepared to accept the fact that greatness in the presidency may have gone the way of the dodo. You know, I use the word great maybe 10 times during the course of my normal day. It's a great movie. She's a great tennis player. And yet I would have a hard time defining it. On the athletic field, I can define it. I can define it in Hollywood, in the arts, with Nobel Peace Prizes. But you cannot define what you can't see. And where greatness is missing is in our political class. I briefed a bunch of Iraq War veterans 3 or 4 years ago, and I asked them to name one American that they would describe as great in the political field. I gave them 10 minutes. At the end of the 10, they couldn't do it. And they asked me in great frustration, well, who would you say? And I said, Martin Luther King. And they replied, but he's been dead since 1968. And that, in essence, I think, is the problem. We don't want great presidents because greatness in our political system means one thing. It means nation-encumbering crisis. Our three greatest presidents won a century, Washington in the 18th, Lincoln in the 19th, Franklin Roosevelt in the 20th, all presided over the greatest crises that this nation has faced. So if you want a great president, buckle your seatbelt because you're going to have a crisis. We want good presidents, good in the sense that they are good at what they do, competent, good in the sense that they function within ethical and moral parameters. They're good human beings. And good in the sense that they have emotional intelligence. They can keep their own personal demons under control.
But do we really want that? I mean, or do we just want the economy to be doing well? Honestly.
Well, I mean, I think when, you know, presidents benefit from an economic cycle, they frankly have very little control over it. They could screw it up, but it's very difficult for presidents to micromanage and make decisions that fundamentally presidents claim, including our current president, that in effect he is responsible for the economic boom. But no, I think Americans want more than that. And I think you could argue, and that's where the chattering classes are these days, that the next election, 2020, will somehow be a struggle, not my phrase here, for the soul of America. And I just want to add one quick note. You know, I've worked for Republicans and Democrats, and I've voted for Republicans and Democrats. It's an increasingly important point because I believe fundamentally there is something called the national interest, both with respect to our domestic policy and our foreign policy. The divide is not between left and right, not between liberal and conservative, and not between Democrat and Republican. It's, in my judgment, between dumb on one hand and smart on the other. And the only thing that matters, Jennifer, is, in essence, which side of the line do you want America to be on? The smart side or the dumb side? If you want it on the smart side, you don't demonize your opponents. You don't engage in ad hominem. If you want America on the smart side, you borrow ideas from wherever they come. And you fundamentally understand that this is a big tent and not just tolerate, but accept the reality that all points of view need to be debated honestly and effectively in the public square.
Our guest is Aaron David Miller, scholar, author, CNN analyst. Our phone number, if you have a question for him, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. You're a Middle East expert. What do you make of the announcement about Israel allowing the construction of 715 housing units for Palestinians?
I mean, I think it's a tactical decision on the current government. The current Prime Minister of Israel, Mr. Netanyahu, having surpassed David Ben-Gurion in July, is the longest governing prime minister in the history of the state of Israel, is running for another election on September 17. I think that the nod on the houses was designed as a favor to Mr. Kushner, who is now having recently left Israel, and his forthcoming peace plan. But at the same time, the Israelis announced 6,000 units to be constructed for Israelis on the West Bank. So it's one step forward in this process and one step backward.
Are you optimistic?
You know, I don't really use that word. I'm a realist. My late mother said that life is about a glass that fills up. It's neither half empty nor half full. It fills up every day with new opportunities, new challenges, sadly, tragedies and setbacks. The only thing that counts in life is how you respond to the filling glass and how you analyze it. So I'm trying to, having been involved in this for half a dozen secretaries of state in a half a dozen administrations, and having believed deeply in the possibility that Israelis and Palestinians can find a way forward, I find myself 25 years later, almost on the 19th anniversary of the Camp David summit, which I was honored to attend in July of 2000, with hope, but without many illusions.
Mm. Let's talk about the Iran policy, what's going on in the Strait of Hormuz with oil tankers. Well, one seized, others attacked. Just an article in the New York Times this morning about how our allies in Western Europe do not want to take part in any kind of protective convoy. What do you make of the Trump administration, the Iran policy, and what's unfolding right now?
I mean, I'm not going to sit here as an advocate for the Iranian regime, which is a serial human rights abuser, executes more people every year than any other country, with the exception of China. But the reality is Iran is a reality in the region. This administration, because it believed that somehow it could get a better deal or a new regime, walked away a year ago from an agreement that was highly flawed but functional. It was designed to restrain and constrain Iran's putative search for a nuclear weapon, or at least a nuclear program that would allow Iran to develop enough fissile material to produce a nuclear weapon. They walked out on it, convinced somehow that their maximum pressure campaign would induce the Iranians to go back to the table. Maybe they will resume negotiations. But in the process, we are in a period of great tension. I don't believe wars happen by accident. They're preceded by a period of tension in which both sides take a series of steps carefully calculated to avoid conflict. But I'm not entirely persuaded we're going to be that lucky this time around.
You wrote an essay just a couple weeks ago where you say we could be headed for an unnecessary and potentially disastrous conflict with Iran. When you look around the world, is Iran what scares you the most right now?
There are a lot of things that keep me up at night. But I must say about the current administration, perhaps one of its most redemptive aspects is the president's, Mr. Trump's, determination to avoid getting the United States involved in new wars. Iran obviously may be an exception, and out of unwinnable ones. This is not a risk-ready president. If you look at when he has used military force, it's been quite proportionate and quite deliberate. So I believe Iraq and Afghanistan, we need to withdraw in a sensible, calculated manner. But we cannot win these wars. I don't think Mr. Trump wants a war with Iran. I think it's bad politics. It's going to ensure higher oil and gas prices. And it's going to upset his domestic base. He ran on a program of bringing Americans home from areas of combat, not getting them involved in new and unwinnable wars. I think a conflict with Iran would be a disaster, truly.
What about attempts to negotiate with North Korea? You know, I know many in the foreign policy establishment are horrified, but others say, why not? Nothing else has worked.
You know, I guess I would put myself in the latter category. I think it was high time that we started talking to North Korea rather than about North Korea. I think it's quite anomalous, though, that the president of the United States manages to engage with a guy, perhaps the world's last true dictator, a serial human rights abuser, an exporter of terror, a man who's presided over the forced starvation of hundreds of thousands of his own people, and yet won't enter into a effort to test whether or not we could find a way out of this crisis with Iran. But I think Mr. Trump sees North Korea as his deal. I think he sees it as his ticket into the history books, if he could ever actually negotiate a deal with Kim Jong-un. And I think he's prepared, because so much of our foreign policy, and again, I'll remind you, having voted for Republicans and Democrats and worked for them too, I really do believe that this administration's foreign policy, and I've seen transitions from R to D, D to R, D to D, R to R, never seen an administration's foreign policy so influenced by domestic politics on one hand, and the personal sensibilities, fears, and expectations of the president. This foreign policy should be driven by a calculation of national interest. And I think, at the risk of alienating many of Mr. Trump's supporters, you do have a president who really doesn't know what he doesn't know and is not in a hurry to find out. I remember as a young intelligence analyst sitting in my office during the Lebanon War in 1982. Phone rings. It's the State Department Operations Center. Hold. The White House sit room wants to talk to you. Next voice I hear, Aaron, this is George H.W. Bush. He's the Vice President of the United States. He says, I know you're really busy, but I read one of your memos on Lebanon. Do you have a few minutes to talk about it? I mean, Jack Kennedy used to call the Vietnam analysts at the State Department when he didn't feel he was getting the information that he needed. The fact that Bush 41 made that call, that's the kind of commander-in-chief you need. Curious, intellectually honest, and willing to test pre-existing propositions.
Give me an example of what you mean by domestic policy controlling foreign policy.
I mean, all administrations come into office wanting to put their own fingerprints, their own mark, their own stamp on policies, both foreign and domestic. But rarely has an administration entered office determined to overturn all of the policies of his predecessor. The fact that the Secretary of State and the President of the United States is still talking about Barack Obama 2.5 years into the presidency is stunning. Well, where do you want to start? Climate change. Why did we leave the Paris Agreement? A Trans-Pacific Partnership. Why wasn't that followed up on? The Iran Nuclear Agreement. What was the national interest in deviating and actually leaving that accord? Why did the president feel, with no pressure from the Israelis, none, that it was high time to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of the state of Israel and actually open an embassy there? These are decisions, in my judgment, and I'll take the hits that will be coming on some of these issues. These are policies not based on the national interest of the United States. They're based on the personal predilections and domestic politics of the occupant of the White House. And frankly, that's no way to run the railroad.
We are speaking with Aaron David Miller. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have your comments and questions. Eager to hear what you're thinking about. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Jackson Laboratory, nonprofit genetics research in Bar Harbor, discovering precise genomic solutions to disease. JAX.org. And New England Forestry Foundation, celebrating 75 years of conserving forests for future generations. Learn more at newenglandforestry.org.
Your financial contributions to public radio basically make it all happen. You know that. Public radio couldn't be, wouldn't be, the public radio that stands out, that you count on, if it weren't for listener support, your support. So thank you. Our Let's Grow Together campaign is coming up. It starts on Tuesday, and with your help, we'll bring it to an end quickly. So please reflect on the value of this service and do your part if you aren't already. If you are already a supporter, thank you. And do remember that you can make an additional gift or increase your monthly pledge as well. It will all help. MainePublic.org, and thank you.
In celebration of the addition of 102.3 FM to the Maine Public Classical Service, which is now serving much of York County. Maine Public is partnering with Music on Maine in Kennebunk to hold a free community classical concert featuring the Boston Classical Trio. You're invited to join us. Come meet the people of Maine Public and enjoy some great classical music. The event takes place this evening at 6 at the Waterhouse Center on Main Street in Kennebunk. The event is free, but seating is limited, so you should reserve a spot, and note that portable beach chairs are encouraged. Please visit mainepublic.org and click on events for more information.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, your chance to ask Aaron David Miller about world affairs. Aaron David Miller is a global affairs analyst for CNN and the author of 5 books, including the national bestseller Too Much Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace, and most recently, The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll start with an email from Jim, Aaron. He writes, do you think the administration's actions relative to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem and the recent Bahrain conference, have helped to mitigate that conflict? How has the U.S. ability to productively contribute to the effort to resolve this conflict been affected by these actions?
It's a great question. And again, I do not put me down in the undecided column on this. I maintain hope against most rational and logical analysis that there still remains a prospect and political space for a two-state solution. What I don't have any longer are my illusions. If you want a two-state solution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or you want to have a serious discussion about it, then you need to be honest and admit 3 things. You need leaders who are masters of their political houses, not prisoners of their constituencies. We do not have leaders of that character, either on the Israeli or Palestinian side. Number 2, you need a sense of ownership. I don't know if you're familiar with the great philosophical notion that in the history of the world, nobody ever washed a rental car. I use this line all the time. People don't wash their rental cars. Well, most people. Why? Because they don't own them. And unless there is sufficient ownership between Israelis and Palestinians, that is to say, they care more about resolving this conflict than the United States, the French, the UN, we're not going to see it resolved. And finally, you need a U.S. policy that is honest, effective, and prepared to apply a lot of honey, because these parties are going to need a lot of reassurance. But we're also going to have to apply a lot of vinegar, because it's going to be very tough. And we've been effective brokers before. Jimmy Carter, Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, Jim Baker on the way to Madrid. So we have a role to play. So none of these factors exist now, which is why I think most of what the Trump administration has been doing, and I've had several meetings with Mr. Kushner. First time I met him, I said, I wish my father-in-law had as much confidence in me as your father-in-law has in you, because he's given you Mission Impossible. And that's really what we have. So no, economics is important. The Bahrain conference, if tied to a political solution, would provide the necessary resources. I think actually the act of moving the embassy or opening an embassy, the embassy actually didn't move, opening an embassy in Jerusalem has prejudged and predetermined what we need the most when the two parties come to us, and that is U.S. credibility and effectiveness in negotiation. And I think the Trump administration has lost much of that.
Mm. We'll go to Ted, who's calling from the Lewiston area. Hi, Ted. Go ahead.
Hi. What are your comments on Western precision-guided weapon transfers to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates that are used against civilian targets in Yemen?
Yeah, thanks. It's a great question. I have spoken on this. I have written on this. I've gotten to trouble on this. But I think the U.S.-Saudi relationship, frankly, is fundamentally out of control. Saudi Arabia is an important country to the United States, but in my judgment, it is not a strategic ally. It is not confronting Iran as expanding opportunities for Iranian influence in the region, including as a consequence of its policies in Yemen. On the issue of human rights, Mohammed bin Salman, a.k.a. MBS, has done some quite remarkable things, changing the guardianship laws, allowing women to drive, opening up media events for young Saudis. but he's also become incredibly repressive. And the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, a man who was supposed to come to the Wilson Center as a visiting Arab journalist, was an act so abominable. And our unwillingness, Congress is on the case, including today when a joint resolution, two senators introduced a resolution to restrict the visas of Saudis implicated in that killing. We have surrendered not just the moral high ground in not following up on who killed Jamal Khashoggi, as if there was any doubt, but this is also a question of American national interest. And Yemen has been a complete and utter disaster. It is not going to be resolved by a Saudi air or ground campaign. And I think it's a tragic humanitarian disaster, perhaps one of the worst in the world.
Jamal Khashoggi was a friend of yours, wasn't he?
Yes, I knew him and I liked him. I would describe him as a Saudi patriot. He wasn't interested in a revolution. I think he realized that change needed to come, but it had to be accompanied by opening up political channels of debate and discourse, not closing them down. And Mohammed bin Salman has done precisely the opposite, and the United States, frankly, has acquiesced in this process for reasons that are difficult for me to understand.
Ted, thanks so much for your question. We'll move on to Mary Ellen, who's calling from Camden. Hi, Mary Ellen. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. A quick comment. The speaker mentioned national interest, and I just wanted to say that Donald Trump's never had national interest as his concern, and I don't think he even understands what it is. My question actually concerns King Abdullah of Jordan. I was struck by an interview he did a couple of years ago in which he said, if the West would just let us settle our own differences, we could do that. Now, he was educated in the area that I'm from in the United States, and I think he was deeply affected by that, and he seems like a very reasonable and measured person to handle some of this. Do you have thoughts on that?
You know, I do. King Abdullah is quite an extraordinary leader, succeeding his father, who was the longest governing monarch in the world, King Hussein, with the death of King Seboza of Swaziland. Abdullah has managed and navigated a very difficult course. I met with him several times. He's also bears the distinction, and this is a testament, frankly, to his openness, of actually being in a Star Trek Next Generation episode. He's got a great sense of humor. He's presiding over a country which shares the longest and arguably least defensible border with Israel and is sandwiched between a patronizing Saudi Arabia and a potentially unstable Syria and Iraq. So he has his work cut out for him. He is, I think, trying to find a way, per your quoting his comment, to manage the self-reliance and the resilience of the Arab world to take responsibility for some of their conflicts. I think that is needed, with the reality that the United States should try to be helpful and not get in the way, not make resolution of those conflicts any more difficult.
Mary Ellen, thanks for calling in. We'll go to Larry in Bangor. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi. You're a diplomatic kind of guy, and I'm a mathematician, physicist, kind of opposite. But my question has to do with the disparager-in-chief. How much permanent damage is he doing to our international relations? And equally, Mr. Brown, if he does get his hard Brexit, is there any do you think there's much chance of Northern Ireland starting up the troubles again?
I think if the backstop, first on the Brexit question, I think the backstop issue fails and you end up with a hard border between Northern and Southern Ireland, I think you really do stand a chance of exacerbating something that a Mainer, George Mitchell, played such a heroic role in negotiating the Good Friday Agreement. As far as Mr. Trump's concerned, look, and by the way, I'm not sure diplomacy and math are all that much in conflict. Both require, if they're honest, a degree of calculation and thought. But I appreciate the comment. Disparager-in-chief, look, what can I say? I work for six administrations. We've never really encountered a character like Mr. Trump. I have a fundamental belief. My kids sometimes, having just turned 70, my kids sometimes think that I'm too old and not in touch with what's actually happening in the country. But, you know, my own view is, and I don't want to use the Civil War as a baseline, that would be difficult. But the United States has been through an extraordinary amount of struggle over the course of its 2.5-century history. And, you know, my own view, and I will refer to the Civil War, we got through blue and gray. And blue and gray was incredibly costly to this nation. Had it not been for Abraham Lincoln, I'm not sure we would have. And if we got through blue and gray, if we got through the civil rights movement, if we got through riots in the inner cities, if we got through 9/11, then surely we could find a way, having gotten through blue and gray, to overcome red versus blue. I have a profound faith in this country, truly profound. Now, I also can't read the future. And the damage that has been done to norms, conventions, our institutions, the whole character of what it means to be an American is quite profound. I say that as someone who worked and voted for both Republicans and Democrats. And I don't have an answer for you. I don't want to whistle past the graveyard and pretend that somehow, oh, we'll get through this, not get through it, that we will fundamentally overcome it. But I think now, more than any other time in the nation's history, it's really, really important that we understand some of the basic principles of this country and what those who have come before us managed to overcome and have left to us in our care. And I worry, I really do worry, that there's a degree of carelessness and recklessness that exists in this administration that doesn't understand the gift and the treasure that they are responsible for handling. I'll only conclude by saying this. All of our presidents, and I would even include Richard Nixon, understood that in order to serve this country, you had to find a way consistently to turn the M in me upside down so that it became a W in we. That is the fundamental flaw and challenge that we confront with this administration. And I worry about it greatly. But I also believe, as Jack Kennedy described himself as an idealist without illusion, that we'll find a way to overcome it.
Larry, thank you for your question. We'll move on to Westbrook and Constantino. Hi, Constantino. You're on the line with Aaron David Miller.
As Jack Kennedy describes
Constantino, himself, are you on a speakerphone by chance? And if you are, could you pick up the phone?
Larry, thank you for your question.
Shoot, I'm sorry. You're just completely not, we're not able to understand you at all. If you could call back, I'd really appreciate it. And I'll use this opportunity to say we're speaking with scholar Aaron David Miller. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd love to hear what you are thinking about. What are you following in the world? What concerns you? What perplexes you? Give us a call. 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Send an email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet @MainCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Main Calling with help from Lee Honda. With the new Honda Clarity plug-in hybrid, designed to travel 47 all-electric miles before switching to gas. LeeHonda.com. And Frenchie's Maine Woods Bug Dope, made with essential oils and formulated to protect you from mosquitoes, black flies, and ticks. Frenchiesnatural.com.
Hey, this is Elsa Chang from All Things Considered. Public radio is a partnership. NPR and Maine Public Radio bring you accurate news, intriguing interviews, and thought-provoking conversations 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. In exchange, we ask that you consider making a contribution that helps support it all. Whether you donate $10, $20, or $100 a month, your support encourages public radio to grow. And when public radio grows, it can do more to help you grow. We grow together. Here's how you can get involved.
You can contribute right now at mainpublic.org or by calling 1-800-866-1475. Let's grow together.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Jared Diamond, the author of Guns, Germs, and Steel, discusses his new book about the rise and fall of civilizations around the globe. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
Join us later today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the latest on national and international affairs. My guest is Aaron Miller, a distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center International Center for Scholars and a global affairs analyst for CNN. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number 399-3566. Again, 399-3566. During the break, Aaron and I were chatting about a column you're working on. You're looking at some historic trends in the presidency.
You know, presidential trivia is a lot of fun. Who was the last president born in a hospital? Or excuse me, who was the first president born in a hospital? Or who was our only lifelong bachelor president? The answers are Jimmy Carter and James Buchanan. But sometimes presidential trivia can be more than trivial. And it's fascinating to consider that we've now had three two-term presidents in a row, Clinton, Bush 43, and Obama. The last time that occurred in American history, minus the FDR exception, a man elected to four presidents until they passed the 22nd Amendment in 1951. The last time that happened was Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe. And it's a fascinating fun fact to consider about what it says.
Mm-hmm.
Does it mean that we've come to a point where the power of the incumbent is so formidable that, in fact, it's very difficult to dislodge a sitting president? I mean, history would suggest that of the last 11 elections in which incumbents ran, in only three cases, did the incumbent lose. And that's a cautionary tale for 2020. Does it say that we're forgiving or forgetful of the transgressions and mistakes of a first-term president and are willing, because we're risk-averse or want to give the president another chance or wary of change? Does it mean that we are margin for keeping the he and one day she in the White House overrides any sense of change? There are certain inflection points where change is possible. And I think it's instructive as we look toward 2020 to keep that in mind. One last point. Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe all live within 30 miles of one another. They were friends. They were of the same political party. We have managed to elect three different presidents, two Democrats and one Republican, with different programs, policies, and personalities. I find this trend to be really stunning.
Well, it's interesting to me, as you said that, I did some quick math in my head, and it occurs to me there's an entire generation of Americans for whom this is what's accepted as the status quo.
Fascinating. The last one-term president was George H.W. Bush. And that was, as my kids will remind me, that was a long time ago.
We'll go to Billy, who's calling from Augusta. Hi, Billy. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing, Sam? Thanks for taking my call. I know you guys are under some time constraints, so I wanted to ask a couple of quick questions. Maybe I can get yes or no answers, and maybe you can elaborate after I've asked them. My first question is, I wonder if you think or feel or know that Iran probably was going to be building a nuclear weapon, whether we had a deal with them or not. And the other question is, do you think that any talk with North Korea is good talk? Thanks very much. I'll listen off the air.
I think the Iranians are driven by a fundamental mix of grandiosity on one hand and insecurity on the other. And nations that have this unique combination want nuclear weapons. So the answer to your first question is, I think if the Iranians could easily manage it and get away with it, yes, they would want to develop a nuclear program which would leave them a year max away from producing enough fissile material to make a bomb. Like North Korea, like Pakistan, like India, and even like the Israelis. So the answer is yes. And that's why the Iran nuclear agreement, flawed as it was, was still highly functional and designed to keep the Iranians at least a year away from achieving that goal. On the second question, which was North Korea, again, I think, and CIA will confirm this and has, Kim Jong-un is not going to give up his nuclear weapons. And frankly, if you were in Pyongyang running the country, you probably wouldn't either. So the real question is, can you get a freeze on ballistic missile technology to deliver a nuclear weapon and on the production of nuclear material? But you're not going to get to a point, and I think Mr. Trump must understand this, where Kim Jong-un is going to put all his nukes in FedEx boxes and ship them out of the country.
Graham on Facebook says, excellent topic and wonderfully informed guest. My question is, do you anticipate if conflict opens up with Iran, will Trump try to reinstate the draft?
The answer is no. Most professional military officers and planners, and certainly most of our politicians, regardless of what party they belong to, understand the risks and the lack of advantages of a military draft. I think it's not going to happen. I think that in many respects, as I mentioned to you, I'm stunned by the fact that out of 10 Democratic candidates on that stage, with the exception of Tulsi Gabbard, who has served, none of them, in their opening or closing statements, dealt seriously with the two longest wars in American history in Iraq and Afghanistan. That means to me that the military is at war, but the country isn't, and that's a terrible situation to be in. When my father put on a uniform in 1941, there were 16 million Americans. Roughly 12% of 130 million people went to war. It was part of the experience and defined a generation. Some kind of national service, in my judgment, is critically important. But no, the military draft, I think it's gone the way of the dodo.
We'll go to Mike calling from Portland. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Yeah, before I get to my thing, I have been a proponent of the draft for a long, long time, just because it puts skin in the game and it gets us involved in what we're doing. What I had called about was, you mentioned earlier that you're essentially optimism in the United States to recover from bad things that have been happening. But, you know, my big concern now is that with everything we have done and are apparently going to continue to do to harm the environment, that makes it simply an existential issue that we've never really faced before. And with all of our technology and our lack of ethics and morality, we're like kids with grenades here. So given the fact that there are going to be some serious environmental stuff going on, how's that going to affect things? I really am very pessimistic about the future of this nation. I'm really honestly just hoping for a kind of a level glide path to survival.
I mean, it's very well said, and I worry about it as well. And the great change with climate, even though there are steps that we could take that would slow down, someone used the analogy of a train sliding down a hill. The train is going to continue to slide. The question is, can you create a braking system that slows the slide of the train? And obviously, we were on track to some degree with the Paris Climate Agreement, but now we've derailed. And I think the problem partly is how do you create the political incentives, the resources, and the commitment to deal with a problem that a generation yet unborn will experience and suffer from? I mean, melting of the Greenland ice cap would raise the level of the seas 20 feet. I mean, that puts Portland, Boston, in harm's way in an existential manner. You see these dystopia films. I watch them on TV all the time. They're chilling about what happens in the event of a national disaster. I'm not an optimist, but I have not the right. I have two grown children, and I occupy this planet for a brief period of time. I cannot bring myself, given my kids and generations yet unborn, to say never, that we can't somehow manage this problem. I have no illusions left about the degree of difficulty, but it's morally unconscionable for me to give up hope and give up on the reality that we cannot at least cope with a view toward resolving some of the problems, particularly climate, the one you referred to.
You talk about sea level rise. In the shorter term, are you concerned, especially as an expert in a part of the world that's very hot and has a lot of drought, with the onslaught of climate migration in the next couple decades?
Yeah, because, and the Defense Department is actively looking at this issue because it has we talk about foreign policy, and I complained on Twitter last night out of that line from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Foreign policy, anyone, national security, anyone. The reality is climate is as much a foreign policy, national security issue as any of the issues that weren't discussed over the course of the last 2 days. So, yes, the problem you referred to is a critical one and will increasingly become more so.
We'll go to Mark, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Yeah. Earlier this week, I saw on C-SPAN the AG's report on Afghanistan. I'm retired, so I can watch such things. But the report that wasn't very positive. It talked about, U.S. military and aid, poor management, rapid turnover, changing goals, and a lot of waste and material. And it didn't seem to get much traction. And two is that, how do you extricate yourself from a situation where no one really wants to leave? Because I read recently where some senior officer said, well, if we leave there, we'll open it up to terrorism. It's sort of like the domino theory that you can't leave these countries.
I mean, it's a real problem. And this is not an I told you so, but the reality is the standard for victory for both Iraq and Afghanistan was never could we win conventionally. There are limited uses to American military power, fundamentally altering the political balance, protecting the constituents of a country, getting them to exercise transparency, the absence of corruption, good government, is well beyond the capacity of the United States. I asked somebody the other day, with the exception of Japan and Germany, where victory was total and the war was fought for national security purposes, but it was morally just. Give me one example, just one, where the projection of American military force fundamentally altered the internal politics of another country in a sustainable way that made it better forever. Now, you could say Bosnia, Kosovo, those are limited examples, and they're fraught examples. So these are unwinnable wars. The standard for victory is never can we win, but when can we leave, and what are we going to leave behind? I do not subscribe to the notion that if we depart, somehow we are going to open ourselves up to terror against the domestic continental United States. Since 9/11, there has not been a single successful terror attack generated by a foreign terrorist organization. You could argue that has a lot to do with the fact that we were in Afghanistan and Iraq, but 9/11 did not occur because Osama bin Laden was running around in Afghanistan. It occurred because 19 guys managed to penetrate American borders 68 times, train at U.S. flight schools. The absence of coordination with law enforcement, CIA. We're much better now. We really are. And the mission and purpose in Afghanistan, frankly, has been lost. And it's time, and several of the Democratic candidates, I think all of them, even Cory Booker, whose reaction was quite nuanced, claim that if they were elected president, they would head for the exits. But as Barack Obama knows, and Trump as well, Once you're president, you have responsibility for withdrawal, and withdrawal without victory never looks good for America.
Mark, thanks for your question. An email from Mary Ellen. Does Mr. Miller see anyone who could be effective in foreign policy like Jimmy Carter was post-retirement?
You know, I that's a fascinating question. I interviewed Jimmy Carter for both of my books, the one on the Arab-Israeli peace process and the one on the presidency. I find him to be a remarkable individual, and he's made great contributions. But I also truly believe, and not that presidents can contribute after their presidencies are over, the time for wisdom and prudence, for bold action, for effective action, is when you hold the con, when you actually have the power. I thought you were going to ask a different question. Who might be the kind of individual that we would be effective to govern the nation? And this gets back to the whole question of what kind of president are we looking for? And I think every American, since it's the only national office, the only one that we can all vote for, that we all have a stake in thinking very, very carefully about this. The power of the presidency has been vastly overrated. Public's imagination of Harrison Ford in Air Force One single-handedly killing terrorists. But it is still one of the most resilient, extraordinary institutions. The Energizer Bunny of American foreign policy. Supreme Court goes in and out of session, so does the U.S. Congress. The president never goes out of session. And that means qualities in a president, prudence, moral character, curiosity, intellectual honesty. Last point. The Constitution uses the personal pronoun only once. I didn't know this until I started researching my book on the presidency. Why would the founders have put the word I in the U.S. Constitution? Well, the answer is they embedded the inaugural oath in the document. And they did that, in my judgment, for a reason. Power of that office flows from the document and from the public, and from you and me. Harry Truman once quipped that Nixon may have read the Constitution, but he didn't understand it. It's a cautionary tale.
Well, that's going to be the last word. I apologize to all of you still hanging on the line or with an email, but we are out of time. Thank you, Aaron. Aaron David Miller, distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center, International Center for Scholars, a global affairs analyst for CNN, and the author of 5 books, including most recently, The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Lucy Suchek ran the board today, and Cindy Hahn took your calls. Main Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. This program will be rebroadcast tonight at 8. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Public Radio.